So I've got a story of three dates for you. The first date is today, and that's a date in January 2022 when I'm recording this message for you. The second date is 9 years earlier, in January 2013. And in January 2013, I was invited to give a TEDx talk. And at the same event was the controversial biologist Rupert Sheldrake, who also gave a talk. Rupert and I, a month later, both had our talks taken offline by TED because the talks challenged the orthodox narrative about consciousness. And that brings you to the third date, which is the date that the dialogue between Rupert and myself that you're going to be seeing shortly was recorded. And that dialogue was recorded in November 2021, and it was recorded for the Beyond the Brain conference series. And I highly recommend the Beyond the Brain conference series to anybody who gets a chance to tune into their future events. What we've done with this recording is that we've added quite a number of images, particularly images from the great visionary artist Pablo Amoringo, who kindly gave me permission to use his images in connection with my book Supernatural, which is soon going to be re-released in America under the title Visionary, with new material added. So let's go straight to the dialogue between myself and Rupert Sheldrake. And I'd like to say at the beginning that I have huge admiration for Rupert Sheldrake. He's a serious scientist who has brought the tools of scientific investigation to the mystery of consciousness, perhaps the greatest mystery of science.
I say a very warm welcome, everybody, to Beyond the Brain 16 in 2021 online. Both of these speakers are very well known to you all. They have the privilege of their TED Talks being banned, and they're going to be talking about the nature of consciousness and the limits of scientific paradigm, which is essentially the central theme to Beyond the Brain. So, Graham, I'm going to hand right over to you for your kind of opening statement.
Okay, well, first of all, I want to say I'm not a scientist. I am a journalist. So I find myself in esteemed company here that I cannot claim any scientific credentials myself. I am an author and a journalist. I write books about ancient civilizations. And I can honestly say that I had, apart from one incident, I had very little interest in consciousness until I encountered the ancient Egyptian books of the dead. Perhaps I should say what that one incident was. That one incident happened to me when I was 18 or 19 years old, and it was a massive electric shock, a near-fatal electric shock. And I distinctly remember, I was very aware of it at the time, that I left my body. And I found myself up around the light in the kitchen where I was, looking down at my body. And I thought, how strange and how interesting, what's going on here? And it didn't go further than that. I was back into my body, and I got up, and I was kind of okay. But that memory of being outside my body and looking down on my body, I think planted in my mind the notion that whatever I am not my body. I'm something else. I'm connected to the body, definitely, but that isn't me. That doesn't define me. And that happened at an early age in my teens. Subsequently, I put it out of my mind for many years until I encountered the ancient Egyptian funerary texts. And I encountered those in the course of my main focus of my work is the possibility of a lost civilization and whether some of the most ancient civilizations provide us with clues to the nature of that lost civilization and indeed to its spirituality. And this required me to read the ancient Egyptian pyramid texts and the derivative versions thereof, which include the ancient Egyptian coffin texts, the book of what is in the Duat, and the famous Book of the Dead. These texts all describe in detail a journey that the soul makes after death, where the soul is confronted in complete transparency and openness with the nature of his or her life and how it was and how it was lived, and is required to account for it. And initially my reaction was, why does this matter? And then when I thought about it more, I thought, well, actually, hang on. The ancient Egyptians put their best minds at work for 3,000 years to try to understand the mystery of death. And perhaps we should listen to what they are saying. As part of this process, this inquiry into the ancient texts, by the way, the Hermetic texts are also stunningly significant and really reach deep into the nature of reality and the nature of consciousness. And they're kind of derivative from the ancient Egyptian texts. But as part of this and beyond this, I then, researching another book, found it necessary to take psychedelics. I was, the book purported or began life as explaining cave art. And I came across a very powerful theory by Professor David Lewis Williams at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa, that cave art and the universal features of cave art all around the world were best explained if the artists had experienced altered states of consciousness and were depicting what they saw in their visions. So I'm a kind of boots on the ground researcher, and I needed to go have those visions. I'd had one LSD trip in 1975, but it wasn't until second half of the 1990s that I began this research with psychedelics, particularly with ayahuasca, the vine of the dead or the vine of souls from South America. And I just had such extraordinary experiences of a seamlessly convincing parallel realm filled with intelligent entities who seemed to want to communicate with me in certain ways and who seemed to convey moral teachings and ask me to examine the nature of my life and the impact that I had on other people. This is a very powerful transformative experience, and it solidified that notion that I am not my body, that I am not my brain, but somehow the body and the brain provide an interface to other levels of reality. In short, reality is much more complex than it at first appears to be. It goes deeper and deeper into layer upon layer, and I'm not sure if we'll ever get to the bottom of it. Over to you, Rupert.
Well, thank you, Graham. That's a very amazing introduction. There's a lot I'd like to discuss with that, but I first of all, I'll just give a kind of general pitch about my own interests in the mind beyond the brain. There's three senses in which I think our minds are beyond our brains. The first is what I call the extended mind, the mind extended in space beyond the brain. And here I'm talking about just ordinary, everyday consciousness, not altered states of consciousness, not out-of-the-body experiences, not electric shocks, not ancient Egypt, but just like now. I think that our minds extend beyond our brains all the time. And I think they do so through fields, fields of the mind, mental fields. We're used to the idea of fields extending beyond material objects from magnets, where there's a magnetic field in and around the magnet, from the Earth, where there's gravitational field in and around the Earth, from mobile phones, where there's electromagnetic field within and around the mobile phone invisibly. This room's full of mobile phone transmissions and TV and radio transmissions. Everywhere is. And I think our minds extend too, and particularly through vision. When we look at something, I'm looking out of the window at a tree, for example. I think my image of the tree is where it seems to be, where the tree actually is. I'm projecting out a three-dimensional full-color virtual reality display onto the world around me. And so is every animal with image-forming eyes, that our minds extend outwards in every act of perception. And that's the word attention means to stretch towards, ad tendere. I think our minds stretch towards things in every act of attention. I think they also stretch into things through intention, which means to stretch into. And I think phenomena like telepathy exhibit that ability. If I think about somebody who I want to get in touch with, I intend to get in touch with them, I go to my telephone, look up their number, thinking about them, they may start thinking about me, they pick up my intention. So when I ring them, they say, "That's funny, I was just thinking about you." And this, I think, underlies the very common experience of telephone telepathy. And the extension of the mind through vision, I think, underlies the well-known phenomenon of the sense of being stared at. People feeling when they're being looked at from behind, they turn around, someone's looking at them. So that's the first sense in which I think minds extend beyond the brain. And these are revealed testably in phenomena like the sense of being stared at and telepathy. Secondly, I think minds extend beyond brains in time. We all know that they do. This is not controversial, through memory and also through thinking about the future. Much of our consciousness is concerned with planning about the future, deciding among possibilities. And those are future possibilities. We also have memories of the past. And I think our memories are not stored inside our brains, which is the conventional materialist view, but rather that we resonate with ourselves in the past by morphic resonance. And there's a transfer of memories across space and time through self-resonance. We resonate with ourselves in the past. We also resonate with lots of other people. And that, I think, is the basis of collective memory, what Jung called the collective unconscious. Individual memory and collective memory differ in degree, but not in kind. Both depend on resonance from the past on the basis of similarity. So our minds are extended in time as well as in space. And the third way in which they're extended is that I think they enable us to contact spiritual realms beyond the normal physical realm. And this happens most spectacularly in mystical experiences, when sometimes spontaneously, sometimes through a near-death experience, sometimes through spiritual practices, sometimes through psychedelics, people feel themselves in contact with a greater or certainly different kind of consciousness. In mystical experiences, people often feel themselves in the presence of a consciousness greater than their own, and part of a vastly larger consciousness or mind. I think this is the underlying insight behind all religions. They all start from a direct experience of contact with a much greater realm of consciousness. The Buddha didn't become enlightened through doing a PhD, but by meditating under trees for many years. Jesus didn't become aware of his deep affinity and connection with God, who he thought of as Father, through going to a rabbinical seminary. It came to him in a great moment of insight at the moment of his baptism, when he was held underwater by John the Baptist in the River Jordan and came up again through a rite of passage, which I think was a kind of near-death experience induced by drowning. I think John the Baptist was carrying out a mass-scale rites of passage through inducing near-death experiences through near-drowning, holding people under long enough. And Jesus's first moment that's recorded in the Bible of deep insight and spiritual awareness happened then. It was followed by his going on a retreat, 40-day fast in the wilderness. So I think that this greater consciousness that we become aware of through mystical experiences also is a way the mind can also be extended to many other forms of consciousness in dreams and in altered states of consciousness and under the influence of psychedelics. We can encounter many other kinds of consciousness, not just the all-embracing consciousness of ultimate reality, which we can call God or the ultimate reality or the all or whatever name we choose, but also many other conscious, intelligent entities. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, these are called angels, and there are countless angels, supposedly, in this tradition. There are also demons or devils or spirit entities of questionable nature. The Hindus have devas, countless shining beings. Muslims have jinns. So monotheistic religions, although they think of a single supreme ultimate source of consciousness, are also very heavily populated by many other kinds of spirit beings to whom we can be open, both in waking life when people feel the presence of these beings, but more commonly in dreams and in altered states of consciousness. So there are three ways, in summary, that I'm suggesting our minds are extended beyond our brains. In normal waking life, through space, as it were, a horizontal connection that connects us to the environment around us and to other people through telepathic connections. These psychic phenomena, like telepathy and the sense of being stared at, are not spiritual. They're part of our animal nature. Animals have telepathy as well and the sense of being stared at. They're part of the extended nature of our minds in space. Extension in time through memory and collective memory and through visions of the future, and also extension to other forms of consciousness that are not in the normal physical world. And it's this last extension that overlaps most closely with what Graham has just told us about, his own experiences and also the texts of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, and so on. So Graham, probably a good starting point would be to look at the nature of these entities, these other beings that people encounter. I confess that I myself don't often encounter other entities in my psychedelic experiences. I haven't met the machine elves that Terence McKenna talked about so clearly. But I do have a strong sense of the presence of other kinds of beings, including angels. And indeed, with Matthew Fox, I wrote a book called The Physics of Angels, about the possible nature of angelic beings. So you talked about many levels of reality. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about how you think of these entities.
Yeah. I started drinking ayahuasca as a research project in order to be able to come from a place of genuine experience in writing a particular book. But I found the experiences so extraordinary and life-transforming that I continued with the work. I would call it work, and I guess I've had somewhere north of 70 journeys with ayahuasca. Many of them do not involve entities. Many of them involve deep self-reflection. In some cases, there are amazing fractals and geometry morphing constantly and changing shape. And then sometimes entities come through. Now, I know that mainstream materialist science would like to convince us that those entities are simply brain candy. They're just figments of they're epiphenomena of our brain activity, as indeed mainstream science defines our consciousness also, and that there's no reality to them. But my experience in a visionary state is that there is a reality to them, that there is some reality beyond this reality, and I find it hard to convince myself that these entities that I encountered, which have from time to time included things like elves and fairies, I find it hard to convince myself that they're not in some way real. In fact, they seem more real than real. And I suppose this is where where the fundamental divide with mainstream science, materialist science comes, is when we have these visionary experiences, what actually is it that we are experiencing? Is the psychedelic in question, or, I mean, psychedelics are not the only way to get into deeply altered states of consciousness, as Rupert mentioned, you know, sitting under a tree and meditating for weeks on end will certainly do the trick. So will hunger, so will austerities of various kinds. There's lots of ways to get into altered states of consciousness. But the question is, once we get into that deeply altered state, which is not the alert problem-solving state that our society values so highly, once we get into that deeply altered state and encounter entities, are they entirely figments of our imagination, or are they real in some sense? And if I look at the sort of evolutionary notion, I think everybody understands we have certain, I can only call them modules in the brain. We have a module for intuitive physics. The example I often give is that if somebody throws a book at me, I probably would be able to dodge that book or to bat it aside with my hand before it hit me. Actually, underlying that dodging or batting the book aside is a very complex series of calculations, which involve the object, the strength of the thrower, the trajectory of the thrower. All of that is being done in an instant by the brain. The brain clearly has a shortcut to work all of this out. And I can understand that in evolutionary terms, because if you didn't have the ability to dodge objects being thrown at you, then you might be less likely to pass on your genes to future generations than somebody who did have that ability. But what I don't understand is why the brain would invest in seamlessly convincing parallel worlds filled with intelligent entities that seek to teach us. I don't see why... Why that would evolve in human beings all around the world. It seems to me that there's something else going on here. So the question is, what are these parallel realms that we encounter, and what are the entities that inhabit them, and how can we inquire into this further? I know at the moment there's some very exciting work being done at Imperial College with dimethyltryptamine, and it's called DMTX. The volunteers are subjecting themselves to extended DMT journeys. Normally, DMT smoked is a 10 to 12 minute rocket trip to the other side of reality. But these volunteers are effectively getting DMT on a drip and are being kept in that deeply altered state for hours, or certainly an hour or more, which I have to say I would find a formidable and terrifying experience, and kudos to them for their courage. But perhaps this is some way to engage in a deep investigation of whatever it is these parallel realms and entities are. As a scientist, Rupert, do you think there is a scientific way to approach this and to establish actually what we're dealing with in visionary realms?
Well, I think there are ways to begin an inquiry. Anyway, actually, I didn't know about the DMT experiments at Imperial College. It's interesting that's another case of life imitating art. Mm-hmm. In Bernardo Kastrup's book, Beyond Allegory, I think it's called, he has a kind of science fiction-y second half to the book, in which heroic explorers undergo experiments with DMT infused into their bloodstream to extend the DMT experience, to explore consciousness more than can be done on these very short-lived DMT trips. So it sounds as if that project is actually bringing into reality something that was part of a kind of science fiction only a few years ago. Mm-hmm. I think myself that the starting point for thinking about these phenomena is dreams, because dreams are altered states of consciousness, which all of us have every night, even though we forget most of them. And dreams begin, according to rapid eye movement detection, even before we're born in babies. Many animals have dreams, at least they have rapid eye movement, and when you watch a dog sleeping and it looks as if it's trying to run in its dream, chase a rabbit or something. Obviously, dogs will have dog dreams and cats will have cat dreams. And we have human dreams. And in our human dreams, there are other entities. I mean, in most of my dreams, I encounter other people, and they're not the real actual people. Some of them are now dead, like my parents. And I encounter people in my dreams and beings and animals that aren't really there. And so in the sense of normal everyday world, the normal everyday world. So actually, I think that the starting point for all these inquiries, for me at least, is dreams. Then there's the question of, can we have shared dreams? Well, many people who've lived together in close quarters or who've taken part in dream groups where they share their dreams on a regular basis and become quite bonded with each other, find that they can have shared dreams. They can meet each other in their dreams, and things can happen to them in the dream which they later remember when they wake up, and their experiences were indeed overlapping. So there's a kind of shared reality within dreams. And then, as a next,
can I just pause you there just for one question? Why does the materialist reductionist faction in science not embrace that as just another faculty of the mind?
They admit the reality of dreams. Of course, they find it impossible to deny them.
Shared dreams.
Shared dreams. They just don't look at the evidence, because shared dreams would imply something telepathic. And for materialists, telepathy is one of the really big taboos.
Let's pause there. Explain why it's a big taboo. Why is telepathy such a big taboo for mainstream materialist science?
Well, because of their belief system. Their belief system is that the materialist belief system is that matter's the only reality, that matter's unconscious. The whole universe is made up of unconscious matter. Our brains are made up of unconscious matter, except, embarrassingly for materialism, we appear to be conscious. That's why the very existence of human consciousness is called the hard problem for materialists. The mind is supposed to be nothing but the activity of the brain. As materialists say, minds are what brains do. Therefore, the mind, according to materialism, is either an aspect of physical brain activity, or it's an epiphenomenon of physical brain activity that does nothing, or it's an illusion produced by brain activity. And the illusion doesn't do anything either. In any case, although these are different schools of materialist philosophy of mind, they all agree that the mind is confined to the inside of the head. The mind is nothing but the activity of the brain. Now, and the brains have electrical and chemical activity, but the electrical effects don't stretch far. You can detect them just by putting electrodes on the skull, but they don't reach out very far. Therefore, for the materialist, the existence of phenomena like the sense of being stared at or telepathy they're impossible, because they couldn't possibly happen. The minds couldn't possibly have an influence on other minds at a distance in some mysterious way, because they're all confined to the inside of the head. Therefore, it's absolutely essential for materialists to deny these phenomena, which is why they have organizations like the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, magazines like the Skeptical Inquirer, and why the materialist hitmen patrol Wikipedia to make sure that biographies of people like you and me are suitably edited to portray us as flakes or pseudoscientists or whatever. It's all to maintain this belief that the mind is nothing but the brain. Therefore, to admit that telepathy could happen in dreams would be a violation of this belief system, and therefore it's taboo. So anyway, the fact is that telepathy does happen despite materialists' belief system, and telepathic contact in dreams happens. And in fact, telepathy quite often happens through dreams. Many telepathic communications occur in dreams, particularly from people who are dying or have had accidents. Many people have dreams about somebody, or when awake, feel the presence of somebody or get some impression of somebody at the moment that person dies, even though they don't know they're dying, and even if they're dying a long way away. This is one of the kinds of episode that so intrigued the founders of the Society for Psychical Research in the 1880s. So anyway, back to the dreams. One of the things that interested me when I was trying to think about these problems was, well, what about entities that are collectively recognized yet can't possibly exist in reality and yet have a real realm in real existence in the realm of dreams or the imagination or altered states of consciousness? So what I thought of as a test case was the Indian god Ganesh. Ganesh appears in temples, in countless statues in India, as paintings of Ganesh appear on calendars. You see them all the time. I lived in India for 7 years and I was very aware of Ganesh all the time. Ganesh is an elephant-headed god who couldn't possibly have existed in any normal physical sense. He's considered to be the remover of obstacles and to be a son of Shiva and a channel of the energy of the god Shiva. Well, does Ganesh appear to Hindus in their dreams? Well, I did a Google search on Ganesh in dreams, and I found in India numerous dream groups where people online are discussing their Ganesh dreams. Yes, lots of Indians have dreams of Ganesh, and they share their experiences with others in online forums. So now, when Ganesh appears in dreams in India, he seems real to the people who are dreaming him. He's a god, and he appears and he can intervene in what's going on. Yet, is he real? What if he's just a product of the imagination? Then if lots of people have a shared imagination and shared experiences of Ganesh, then isn't this some kind of reality? So that's the approach I've been taking towards these questions. What do you think of that as a general line of inquiry?
It sounds very, very worthwhile to me. I'd like to come back to this issue of the mainstream materialist science and consciousness. It seems that you speak of it as a belief system. Those scientists would say it's not a belief system, it's a fact. And of course, you and I both know that it's not a fact. It's not an established fact. It's not established or confirmed by any form of experimentation. We really just don't understand what is going on here. But it looks to me like that particular faction of science wants to exert control over human consciousness. And to limit the scope of what we may explore and discuss about consciousness. And as you rightly say, that faction is extremely active and has its expeditionaries out there on the internet doing their best to slur and scorn the names of anyone who considers anything other than the materialist view of consciousness. And then secondly, I find that we live in a society where actually the state claims to own our consciousness. Of course, it doesn't make that claim overtly or directly, but the very fact that a person may be arrested for possessing or using drugs that alter consciousness is a sign that the state does claim to own our consciousness and to define for us how and in which ways we may use our consciousness. Somebody having a psychedelic experience is, in my view, a free and sovereign adult should have complete free and sovereign choice to do whatever they wish with their own consciousness and minds and bodies, so long as they do no harm to others. And I think it's a sure giveaway that the state seeks to control and limit consciousness, that we have this phenomenon called the war on drugs. That's a direct intervention. If an adult is not free to explore and experience their own consciousness while doing no harm to others, then there's no meaning to the word freedom at all. And we live, I think, in a very sinister environment where attempts are being made to absolutely shut down and limit and control what we may think about. And all kinds of clever techniques are used to do that. And I just wonder why. Is it just that a group of influential people want their view to prevail, or is there some sort of demonic project to, you know, shut down and delimit human consciousness? We have this majestic vehicle, which is our whatever the brain is. It's a majestic and extraordinary thing, and what a pity that it should be so limited by the society we live in. I think there's a useful model concerning the brain and consciousness, and I've mentioned this several times before, and it's the analogy of the TV set and the TV signal. When I look at pictures and images on my TV set, I would be quite wrong to conclude that the TV set is making those images. And that's why I think I would be wrong to conclude that my brain is making the images of entities in the DMT realm. Those images are being beamed into the TV set on a signal. And you can destroy the TV set, but the signal still continues. And coming to your issue of morphic resonance and telepathy, and the issue of memories, you mentioned earlier that they're not stored in the brain. Where then are they stored?
Well, there are several points here, Graham. First, about the state and psychedelics being illegal at the moment. I have a rather ambiguous attitude to that, because I actually quite like the fact they're illegal. And first of all, the law is not very often enforced. I don't know anyone who's been arrested for taking LSD or ayahuasca.
We should make the distinction. It doesn't really matter whether it's psychedelic or whether it's heroin, actually. Adults should be sovereign over their own bodies and consciousness while doing no harm to others, in my view. There's something really wrong with society if that's not the case.
No, I my reason for thinking, the sort of slightly perverse reason for actually not being as worried about it as you, is that as soon as these things are legalized, as we've seen with cannabis in Canada, huge corporations, yeah. Silicon Valley billionaires pour billions into this. So Peter Thiel, who is not everyone's favorite billionaire, is getting into the psychedelic business, you know, huge investments trying to patent psilocybin, and or at least methods of preparing it. And vast corporations, the government might try to control our consciousness, but what if vast corporations control psychedelics and then advertise them on TV, that's an alternative scenario, unfortunately, in the present world.
It's a fair scenario, and you're right, there is a huge commercialization in the cannabis industry and in the psychedelics industry, and hedge funds are getting into this, and it's becoming a big investment opportunity all around. I still like to believe that the plant medicines would subvert that. That our society does seek to restrict explorations in altered states of consciousness because those explorations are subversive. They pull the rug out from underneath the entire structure of the way our society works. And I think they'd continue to do that, whether legal or not, actually.
Yes. Well, I think that the legal thing isn't, you know, right now, and at least in Yorkshire, where I was recently, the meadows are full of psilocybin mushrooms, liberty caps, growing in abundance all over our green and pleasant land. And so, you know, the ability of the state to suppress these things is somewhat limited.
All it can do is generate fear and a sense of oppression. Yeah.
Anyway,
Rupert and Graham, just come in here because there's an interesting point in the chat related to this theme, which is all dominant groups / governments seek to control consciousness and alternative ways of viewing reality. Look at the materialist education system, which is designed to induct children into materialist orthodoxy. What do you think of that point?
I think it's an absolutely correct point. We are from childhood schooled to think and function in particular ways. And increasingly I accept that the mainstream religions have a different view, but increasingly in society we are the forces of communication work to say that there is no spirit, there is no soul, there is no meaning, there is no purpose to life. We are just material objects. This materialist agenda seems to infuse the society we live in every way. And I think ultimately it may be the downfall of our society. We do need to open up to these other realms and other experiences. And I do think that people who've had psychedelic experiences tend to become more questioning of the established framework of quote unquote reality than if we've not had those experiences.
Yeah, well, I also agree. The system we have at the moment is designed to inculcate a kind of materialist worldview. It's highly secular, it's anti-spiritual, anti-religious. On the other hand, we do have in Britain, as in every country, traditional religions as well. And, you know, I myself am a practicing Christian, I'm an Anglican, I go to church, and it is still the established church. So there's a peculiar ambiguity about our state, because part of it that deals with the monarchy and the established church is dealing with ancient archetypes, not just modern materialist worldviews. And for anyone who's a practitioner of Christianity or any other traditional religion, there's no doubt about the existence of entities, you know, angels, saints, the souls of the departed. These are all just part of it. I mean, just a few days ago on Tuesday was All Souls Day, and all over Britain, all over Europe, all over the world, on the Day of the Dead, there were requiems for the departed. I went to one at Westminster Abbey. It was absolutely beautiful, with marvelous music and lighting candles. I was lighting candles for people I know who died. And this is huge in Mexico. So the idea of the departed, a relationship with the departed, a continued existence of the departed, realms of angels and saints who exist in some other realm, all these things are not just flaky New Age views, etc. They're part of the mainstream of all religious traditions, and shamanic traditions too strongly acknowledge the existence of other entities like animal spirits, the ancestors, and so on. So we do have here in Britain, I mean, in every parish, we have churches with statues of saints and people praying and celebration of St. Michael and All Angels on September the 29th and so on. It's a minority current in British life now, but it's still there. And it reminds us that our ancestors, and still many people today, have not bought into the materialist worldview as the only way of looking at things.
Let's then take this a little further. And your position, as I understand it, and my position, I think, is the same in this respect, is that our consciousness is not our brains. In somehow, the brain is certainly connected to consciousness, but it isn't. It is not the essence of our consciousness. And when you speak of telepathy and the mind extending beyond the brain, and you can support that with experimental evidence, it then raises the question, what happens to us when we die? What is death? And actually, what is life? What are we doing here? Is there any purpose to it? Is there any function to this level of existence? And when physical death comes, does it just all go out like a light, or does our consciousness continue on a journey? Have you given thoughts to these questions, and what do you feel about it?
Well, I have given thought to it, yes. Well, my own view is in a sense quite simple. I think that when we die, we go on dreaming, but we can't wake up anymore because we haven't got a physical body to wake up in. So in a sense, we've spent our whole lives preparing for this through our dreams. And we know from our dreams that, you know, what we dream about depends on our fears, our expectations, our experiences, our memories, our hopes, our desires, that our dreams are very much influenced by us and what we believe, what we think, what we experience. But they're also influenced by factors beyond ourselves, because most of us have dreams that are surprising, that we couldn't actually have made up if we just wanted to make them up. Such surprising things can happen in dreams. So I think that our dreams are the way in which the natural biological basis for this other kind of consciousness that we're preparing all our lives through having dreams for just being in a confined to the dream state after we die. And it's interesting to me that Tibetans practice lucid dreaming. Tibetan lamas, and one of the practices they have in Tibetan Buddhism is the practice that they cultivate lucid dreaming. Well, there are many people in our own society who do too, they cultivate this awareness of dreaming while they're dreaming. So a lucid dream, as you know, is when you become aware within a dream that you're dreaming. And that gives people a much greater control over their dreams. And the reason that Tibetans practice lucid dreaming is that when they die, they think they go into a bardo, a kind of intermediate realm, and the ability to know what's going on in the dream realm and to know how to deal with it, which they've practiced through lucid dreams, serves them well in the otherwise confusing circumstances of being trapped in the dream world when they die.
Fascinating. I think exactly what the ancient Egyptians were doing with their exploration of death and their focus on that. It wasn't morbid. It was preparation for, want of a better word, a journey that comes after death. And that afterlife realm in ancient Egypt is very similar to the bardo of the Tibetans, actually.
Well, I think that the Christian concept of purgatory is very similar too. I mean, the Roman Catholic doctrine of purgatory is an intermediate realm, that when you die, you go into a realm of continued development, which is somewhat dreamlike, where you work through various issues that are unresolved in this life. That makes complete sense to me, and I think it's very similar to the Egyptian and the Tibetan views.
It is.
And the other thing about purgatory is that there's a continued interrelation between the dead and the living, that the traditional Roman Catholic and to some degree Anglican practice of praying for the dead is that you can help them through your prayers and they can also help you through their prayers. So there's this interrelation with the ancestors. And this is taken for granted in most cultures. In traditional Chinese households, there's an ancestor shrine, as there is in Japanese households, where people recognize and acknowledge their ancestors. In African societies, it's absolutely taken for granted that ancestors are part of the society. Even though they're invisible, they're very much interacting with it. And I think that was a very common sense all over Europe. The Protestant Reformation attempted to stop that, break that link with the ancestors and confine the ancestors to a kind of state of immobility and sleep until the Last Judgment, when they woke up judged. They tried to get rid of purgatory in their view, but it sort of come back within the Anglican Church to some degree, and it's still there in the Roman Catholic Church. So I think this is part of our own cultural heritage as well.
It's interesting that the deep psychedelic experiences almost always involve this life review, actually. You're put in a place where you can review your life almost from outside and look at the effect of your behavior upon others and experience how your behavior affected them. It's a fascinating process. Something very mysterious is going on here. I think it's just an incredibly mysterious thing to be alive at all. And I'm not sure if we'll ever get to the bottom of the mystery, but I'm glad that people are at least looking into it.
Well, I think it's more or less as you're saying about these ayahuasca journeys. I think we get an intensified experience of the dream realm through psychedelics. I don't think it's a totally different realm. I think it's the same kind of thing as dreams, but mm-hmm. we're more aware of it, it's much more intense as an experience, and we're more conscious of it. And I think that in the dream world, it's not just solipsistic. I think even in ordinary dreams, the fact people can have shared dreams, the fact people can have precognitive dreams about things that haven't yet happened, the fact people have telepathic dreams, and the fact that dreams can involve shared archetypal forms like Ganesh in the dreams of Hindus, I think suggests to me that the dream realm, our dream realms, overlap with each other and possibly with those of animals as well. You know, dogs dream, and maybe we overlap with the dreams of our pets. And, so I think that this the post-mortal dream state that I'm suggesting we might be in would include not only other people, including our ancestors and friends and those who've gone before us, who died before us, but also the traditional Christian view is that this would also include saints, who are the blessed dead, who've people who've been particularly saintly during this life, who after death are able to help others in the dream state. In the Christian belief, then Christ himself, through having gone through death, is a major figure in that post-mortal realm who can help and guide us in our onward journey. And that's one of the points of what Christians call faith in Christ, is that after death, he'll help us and work with us. And of course, in the Roman Catholic and some Anglican practice of the Hail Mary, the prayer to Mary, Mary is not only the mother, but she's also, as it were, the midwife of the dying process, because the womb is the tomb. Death is like a rite of passage into birth into a new, further state of being. And in the prayer, the Hail Mary prayer, said by all Roman Catholics, is very common in Orthodox churches too, the bottom line is, Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen. And so the people are praying. I pray the Hail Mary every day. They're praying for the help of Mary at the moment of death. So the traditional Christian view is that on our journey after death, we're helped by our patron saint, in my case, St. Mary Magdalene, our guardian angel, the Holy Mother of God, and of course, Christ.
Pretty shamanic.
That's the Christian take on it, and other religions have their own guardians and helpers.
You can see how all these evolved out of shamanism, really. I mean, it's the same essential body of ideas being expressed and interpreted in different ways. Just to come back to this, okay, our consciousness is not our brains. The brains are involved in consciousness, but they don't make it. Our consciousness can be separate from our brains. Our consciousness can survive death and move on into other realms. All of this, I'm in complete agreement with on the basis of my studies and my experiences. But then the question comes, what is this life for? What the universe appears to have invested heavily in making it possible to have a physical life, to be a material being. And yet, if I understand you correctly, and I agree with this point, our physical being is not creating our consciousness. Our consciousness is almost, the body is a sort of avatar for our consciousness. What is the purpose of this whole exercise? We human beings sitting here on planet Earth could not exist without the entire universe surrounding us. An enormous project is underway here. Do we just live one life, die, go on into the Bardo realm, and that's it? Or can we come back? Is this huge experiment in physical life got some purpose? Can we reincarnate? Are there lessons to learn here? What are we all doing in these physical bodies?
Well, I mean, I think that part of it has to be the production of diversity. You know, the Hindus talk about divine leela, divine play, that there's a kind of creativity expressed through the evolutionary process, which seems to be creativity for its own sake. I mean, if you think about the sheer number of flowering plant species or beetles or butterflies and that have been produced by evolution here on Earth. It's there's a kind of gratuitous complexity and richness there. Goes far beyond what you'd need if you just had a functional Earth that needed enough photosynthesis to keep a few species of animals alive or to maintain the oxygen levels in the atmosphere. There's this extraordinary, prolific diversity. So I think sheer creativity, the exploration of the possible, all the possible realms of creativity, which in the human realm is expressed through the arts and through literature and through music and through architecture and through science and through technology and through advertising and all, and through the sheer realm, the sheer many forms that creativity takes, and languages and metaphors and poetry, is paralleled in the whole universe through the sheer proliferation of galaxies, stars, and that seems to be part of the meaning of life, a kind of gratuitous creativity, just for its own sake, an expression of as many possibilities or potentialities as possible. That seems to be part of it. And that is also reflected in our dream lives and in psychedelic experiences, and probably in our afterlives too, this kind of rich creativity that's possible through the imagination. And one of the realms of consciousness, I think one of the most important parts of consciousness, is it's about possibility. It's what contains possibilities. And the traditional view of divine consciousness in Christian theology, particularly St. Anselm, who was Archbishop of Canterbury around the year 1100, is that is the divine imagination. God's mind contains all possibilities, all conceivable forms, which are limitless in number. So that seems to be part of reality. There doesn't seem to be, we're not necessarily on a single journey to achieve a single goal. And so that, I think, is part of the meaning of life and part of the reason we're here.
Do you believe that reincarnation is possible? I mean, you should do if consciousness is separate from the brain.
I'm not a dualist exactly, in the sense that I don't see the body, the traditional dualist view is consciousness totally separate from the brain, comes into a body, goes out and goes into another body. I have a slightly different view. I think that all our bodies and all the sleeping people in the world, and while we're awake here in Europe, you know, people are sleeping in Australia and New Zealand. There's constant millions of people at any given time who are asleep and who are dreaming, who are maintaining a kind of collective human dream world, which contains this collective human imagination, which contains dream bodies, including dream bodies of the departed. But you could argue it's sustained by physical bodies of those who are currently dreaming. From this point of view, if all human beings became extinct, the human dream world might stop. But that hasn't happened. So it's just a different way of thinking about it from, you know, a soul leaving a body, going through a body and re-entering another body, totally detached. For me, the reincarnation is not an act of faith, in the sense I don't believe in it or feel I need to believe in it. I think the evidence that of children who remember previous lives, as in Stevenson's studies, is very convincing, that some children who've when they begin to speak, start talking about another life they had before. They name people, they say what they did, they give lots of facts that can be checked up on, and they often turn out to be true. Indeed. What this shows to me is that they're tapping into memories of a previous person. Does it prove that they are that person? Well, then that's a whole question, almost a theological question, that the Hindus and the Buddhists have different answers to and have had for more than 2,000 years. The Hindus think
Does this connect to your morphic resonance work? And can you explain exactly what you mean by that?
Well, yes, I think that the morphic resonance thing is a transfer of memory based on the basis of similarity. And I think we tap into the memories of lots of people in the past through collective memory. But if we tapped into one particular person in the past, we had a sort of amplified memories from one person rather than diluted, they were less diluted than usual in this collective memory, then you could have the transfer of individual memories. The Buddhists would say that rebirth involves a transfer of memories, but it doesn't involve a transfer of the core personality, because there's no such thing as an enduring self. Anatta is one of their doctrine. Hindus think there is an enduring. So the difference between Hindus and Buddhists is both agree about the transfer of memories, but Hindus have a straightforward reincarnation theory and Buddhists don't, even though they both agree about reincarnational rebirth.
It's interesting. I'm lucky enough to be a grandfather. I have six grandchildren and a seventh on the way. And when I see these young beings, these newborn beings come into the world, they already have personalities right from the beginning. They have personalities. Their life experiences will shape and develop those personalities, but they come in already with a personality. And that's one of the reasons I'm really quite attracted to the idea of reincarnation. It makes a lot of sense to me. The universe invests in this huge project of physical life. Why just use it once, you know? There are lessons to learn here. I suppose what I'm coming to is a personal philosophy. I think of physical life as a theater of experience, that we're in some way that I don't understand. I don't go for God. I don't believe in a individual creator God, but in some ways we're here to learn lessons, to learn and to grow and to develop, and in some way to perfect and improve ourselves. And it may take more than one lifetime to do that.
I think that the question of individual identity is rather an ambiguous one, because, you know, we live in a highly individualist society that emphasizes individual differences and individual development. In traditional societies, there's much less emphasis on individual characteristics, more on kind of archetypal roles that people play. But it's also interesting that if you look at the traditional beliefs about life after death, they're really about letting go of our individuality. You know, the absorption into the one or into nirvana in a Buddhist goal, when people are liberated from the karmic bonds, or in Hinduism, when people are liberated, become a free spirit. Liberated from the bonds of habit and karma and memory. That liberation involves letting go of all the things that make us an individual and characterize our particular personal memories and characteristics. And in the Christian tradition too, the idea is that through purgatory, through the ongoing development, we lose our many of the features that make us ourselves. And as St. Paul said, this is an aim even in this life, when he said, "Not I, but Christ within me." The idea is that we are filled with the spirit of Christ, and who becomes a more dominant feature of our personality and our actions than our own idiosyncratic selves, although those are still there. So there's a sense in which most religions involve going beyond our individuality. And many people who take psychedelics, particularly powerful ones like DMT, talk about an ego loss as part of the process. The very details of their own quirky individuality become less and less important as they become part of of this altered state of consciousness, which is transpersonal in many ways.
I'm just, I realize we're coming to the end of this discussion, but I'm just recalling the ancient Egyptian judgment scene, which very graphically and symbolically portrayed that the soul enters into the hall of Maat. Goddess Maat is the goddess of harmony and cosmic justice. Is ushered in, is confronted by a set of scales. On the scales is weighed an object that symbolizes the heart or the soul of the individual. And on the other scale is the feather of Maat, the feather of truth and honor and honesty and cosmic justice. And you don't want your heart to be heavy in the scales against the feather. Sitting around the room are the 42 negative assessors who will ask you questions about the life you've lived. And those questions actually do include the 10 Christian commandments. Have you killed? Have you stolen? Et cetera, et cetera. They're all there. You need to be able to answer no to them, preferably. Moral behavior seemingly is important in the afterlife destiny of the soul. But then there's something beyond that. And the bigger question that lies beyond it is, you were given the precious gift of life. What did you do with it? Did you use it well, or did you squander it? And to come back to the political point, it seems to me we live in a society that's designed to encourage us to squander this incredible gift that we've been given. And I'm not sure what the long-term costs of that will be. But I do think that death is a moment of reckoning, when we must come to terms with the lives we've lived, and that hopefully we emerge from life a more grown and slightly more perfected person than we entered it. That seems to me the Egyptian view, and I kind of like it.
Well, as you say, it's similar in many ways to the Christian view, and I think that the actually, I myself think the Christian view is strongly influenced by the Egyptian view. I mean, in Egypt, this afterlife, particularly the aspect of projection of the pharaohs, I mean, the huge technology of death, the pyramids, the tombs, and so on. But that was for the few. I mean, the average Egyptian slave who built the pyramids and stuff was not, I suppose.
Hang on, I have to correct you there. The pyramids were not built by slaves. That's a myth. There were no slaves in the Old Kingdom. I've climbed the Great Pyramid 5 times. It's a work of genius. Every single person who worked on that was a master craftsman. They knew exactly what they were doing. They were not slaves. But I understand your point. The Egyptian system was focused on the elite and didn't pay much attention to the masses. Yeah, you're right about
that. So whether or not they were slaves, there were slaves later, certainly.
But there were. The Ramesside period, yes.
Yes. Anyway, the point is, for most people, this afterlife that was this whole technology of tombs and the texts and all that kind of thing was not for everyone. And I see one of the points of Christianity is that it would kind of democratize this. Jesus was believed to have ascended into heaven and sort of opened the way for others to follow. So it made it, instead of needing pyramids, tombs, etc., it was made much simpler and much more widely accessible. But I think some of the underlying pattern was the same. I think that was one of the points of early Christianity, that it offered a way into a journey after death that previously was accessible only to a small elite.
Is that just better marketing on the part of the Christians, or is there a fundamental truth there?
Well, I think it's both. I think it was obviously good marketing, but it spread and was very popular. And I mean, the alternatives weren't very attractive. You know, the Jewish vision of Sheol, you go down into a kind of shadowy underworld, or the Greek Hades, you know, these are shadowy underworlds, are much less attractive than ascensions, journeys upwards after death rather than journeys downwards. These are all different models of the afterlife, but I think all of them actually would take place in various different dream realms. And there are many countless realms in dreams. There are nightmares. I mean, some people have nightmares on a recurrent basis. And personally, I think that the Christian descriptions of hell are really descriptions of nightmares, of being trapped, and I would understand those as nightmare-like realms.
And Dante, sorry, I have a controversial question here, but Christianity itself created nightmare worlds, physical worlds, for hundreds and hundreds of years. I mean, the burning at the stake of Giordano Bruno, for example. I'm wondering what moral strength Christianity has to teach us about anything when its principal officials at certain periods of time behaved in this just utterly cruel and obnoxious and vicious and evil, frankly, evil way.
Well, I agree that there were various officials who behaved in a terrible and evil way, but there were officials of the British government who behaved in an evil way. Torture and execution were normal. Does that mean we don't want to be British? And there were atheists who behaved in a terrible way. Stalin, Mao Zedong, yeah. Pol Pot. I mean, they make the Inquisition look like a vicar's tea party.
So you're saying, well, this isn't the function of Christianity as such. This is a general human proclivity to wicked and cruel behavior.
Yes.
Well, I don't think religion should be allowed to cut itself that slack. If a religion has been implicated in centuries of cruelty and wickedness, it has to take some responsibility for that. It can't just pass it off to your human nature. I think it's time actually religions took responsibility for their behavior towards others, as well as preaching about how we should live in the world.
So I hope you found this discussion between Rupert Sheldrake and myself of interest and of use. I'm intending in the long term to start a podcast in which I will have encounters with many interesting people from many lines of work all around the world. But the central theme, as was the theme in our discussion just now, will be challenging the mainstream narrative. There are narratives that control our lives and that seek to control the way we think. And my project is to challenge those controlling narratives.